Today's Taisho will be on Case 5 in the Mumonkan in the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 5 is entitled Kyogen's Man Up in a Tree. Kyogen Osho said, "It is like a man up in a tree hanging from a branch with his mouth. His hands grasp no bough, his feet rest on no limb. Someone appears under the tree and asks him, 'What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west?' If he does not answer, he fails to respond to the question. If he does answer, he will lose his life. What would you do in that situation?" Mumon's comment: "Even if your eloquence flows like a river, it is no avail. Although you can espouse the whole of Buddhist literature, it is of no use. If you solve this problem, you will give life to the way that has been dead until this moment, and destroy the way that has been alive up till now. Otherwise, you must wait for Maitreya Buddha and ask him." Mumon's verse: "Kyogen is truly thoughtful, thoughtless. His vice and poison are endless. He stops up the mouths of the monks, and devil's eyes sprout from their bodies." I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning, on this summer morning. One of our members has been in hospital and had to have surgery, and is mending. But, you know, people think they're in good health, or they assume they're in good health, and then one day they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "You're not in good health." And then life really changes. A good friend of mine went to the doctor. This was almost 15 years ago now, so it has a happy ending. She went to the doctor just for a routine physical checkup. And the doctor did the checkup, and then he noticed a little lump on her collarbone. And he said, "What's this?" And she said, "Oh, it's nothing. It's just a little bump." And he said, "Oh, we better test this." And it turned out to be lymphoma. So my friend really was knocked off her balance, she had a difficult period in her life dealing with this. She had to go quite often, and when she would go to the hospital for treatments, they would actually draw on her body various kinds of lines, and like a map, and they would measure the body and draw these various lines, and then she would get treatments, radiation treatments. After which she felt very tired sometimes, and it was psychologically quite difficult for her. You know, she had been a very athletic person, always taking good care of herself, and trusted everything to be okay, you know. Had a child and gone through the usual ups and downs in life. But, you know, we put a lot of trust in our own bodies, you know. And when you go to the doctor and the doctor says something's wrong, it's like the earth drops away from under you. And suddenly you can feel very bereft, very powerless, and it's an uncomfortable feeling. Anyway, this other person has had the similar experience. Somebody in our group went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, there is something wrong. You know, we're going to have to test, and then test it, and then said we're going to have to operate." And of course, you know, that's very unnerving in itself, waiting to see what's in there, you know, what's going on with my body. The body is so much part of how we define ourselves, it's so much a part of who we are, that when something goes wrong on that level, it's like the ground drops away from underneath you and you have nothing to hang on to. That feeling is really uncomfortable. I don't think anybody likes it. In the case of my friend, from many years ago, she went through her radiation treatments and has had no recurrence of her Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she's still alive and doing well. And her daughter has gone off to college, and I'm happy to say she's thriving. But that period was very, very difficult. And actually, we used to do a lot of sitting together, a lot of meditation together. Now this member of our group is in the hospital, even today in the hospital, and probably feeling like the ground has opened up from underneath. Him. Nobody likes that feeling. Nobody. I was talking last night to a friend of mine who has been teaching in the New Jersey higher education system for maybe 20 years. And he was telling me, he was just reading in the paper about the stock market going down. Over the last couple of years, the stock market has been going up, up, up. And people were happy to see that, because in 2008, the stock market fell apart. A lot of people have their life savings in 401ks and other kinds of retirement accounts. And when the stock market fell apart, people lost huge amounts of their savings. Anyway, my friend has a friend who has taught at Kane University since 1961. So that person must be very, very close. I'm surprised that person hasn't retired, right? That person must be very, very close to retirement. That's almost 50 years, right? That's more than 50 years. 50 years, exactly. And that person must be ready to retire. But anyway, my friend said that his friend had lost in 2008 $400,000, or half of his life savings. And I'm sure that when that happened, it felt like the ground was falling out from under him. It's the most uncomfortable feeling, right? It's like, you know, something you count on, like your body. You get up every day and you put your feet down on the floor when you get out of bed, and the floor is there and your feet are there. And there's that pressure on the soles of your feet, and it's very reassuring. You know? You can feel your body. You bump into things. It's the pivot of your world, right? It's the place you constantly come back to, and it reassures you that you're where you should be, and so on. And of course, when we think about our lives, we're always thinking about the future. We want to control the future. We have savings accounts. We have life planning coaches and financial coaches. And all of that is a way of going forward and trusting things. And sometimes that trust just erodes. It just erodes. And it's very scary, very frightening. And it can be, you know, I imagine this poor man has worked for 50 years, and he was thinking he was just about to retire, and then half of his savings are wiped out. That's like, it's like vertiginous. I don't know if you know that word, but it's like dizzying, terrifyingly dizzying. It's like dangling off of the side of a building by your feet. So, vertiginous, you know, is not a nice place to be. This koan, obviously, is sort of about that experience or that feeling that we get sometime where, you know, this is like a dream. The koan is like a dream. You go to sleep one night and you're in a dream, and in your dream you're hanging from a tree or the branch of a tree. It is like a man up in a tree hanging from a branch with his mouth. So your mouth is holding onto the branch. And as in a dream, it doesn't quite make sense, but when you look up into the tree to find a branch to hang on to, there's nothing you can grasp. And when you look down, there's nowhere to put your feet. So you're just holding on with your teeth to this branch. And it's all you can do not to drop into the Grand Canyon. The tree is over an abyss. And so you're struggling to hold on, to be secure, to be safe. That in itself is very unnerving, right? That feeling of like the ground it could give out from under you. And then the koan makes it even more complicated, because someone appears under the tree and asks him, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west?" Now this is this is an academic Zen question. In other words, the monk, the Indian monk Bodhidharma, brought Zen from India to China. And the question is, why did he do this? And it's really not about historical details. It's about liberation. It's about helping other people. It's about Zen. It's about Buddhism. The koan is really saying, help me wake up. I'm in a quandary. I need your help. I'm trapped in illusion and I don't know the way out. So basically the person is asking the monk who's hanging from his teeth to say something to help him out of his condition of distress, his like a psychological condition of distress. I'm very unhappy, I'm trapped in unhappiness. Can you say something about Zen that will help me to feel better? So this guy is a monk, he's hanging from a branch, he has a moral obligation to help others when he's asked for help. And if he does not answer, he fails to respond to the question. So he hasn't done the thing that he knows he's supposed to do in life. He's supposed to help other people. Somebody in distress is asking for his help. If he opens his mouth to help, though, he's going to fall down into an abyss. So if he does answer, if he answers, he will lose his life. And if he doesn't answer, somebody else will basically, you could say, lose his way in life, you know, become even more trapped, even more distressed, and so on and so on. So what would you do in such a situation? This is the koan. This is really one of the most difficult koans in the book, I would say, in all of the Momonkan, because it gets at something so elemental, so elemental. Many, many years ago, when I came here to New Jersey, I practiced with a Zen teacher who was the Dharma brother of my first teacher, Genki Roshi. This teacher, whose name was Edo Roshi, had a very beautiful temple up in the Catskill Mountains on a lake called Beecher Lake. When Edo Roshi had been in the United States for a number of years. He was teaching in New York in an apartment. And he rented an apartment, and he would have Zazen in his apartment. And word had gotten around that there was this Zen teacher having Zazen practice in his apartment, and people would drift in and do Zazen. One day, a person came into the apartment who was the wife of the president of the 3M company. This is the company that makes Scotch tape and various kinds of business equipment. And she went in to do Zazen, and she had a good experience, and then she brought her husband, a man named Chester Carlson, who was the president of the company. And they became quite enthusiastic about Zazen, and they built, eventually became members of this Edo Roshi's community, and at some point they bought a beautiful 200-acre parcel of land in the Catskills next to a park. And they built this beautiful Japanese-style temple on the edge of Beecher Lake. And when I first went up there to practice, I couldn't quite believe how beautiful it was. It was really extraordinary. You turn off the main road, and then you drive down a dirt road, a gravel road, for miles. It seems to go on and on and on. And you're going deeper and deeper into this forest. And finally, you get to Beecher Lake, and on the far side of Beecher Lake is this beautiful Japanese building, which is like a dream. It's as though somebody magically transported a Japanese temple to the Catskill Mountains. And I was just astonished by the beauty of the whole thing. And I have to say that I was really happy to be there, because I was a young assistant professor at Rutgers, and I was under a lot of pressure at that time. Rutgers is a fairly competitive place, and if you don't publish, you're really not going to survive here. And so I was under a lot of pressure. I was feeling pretty inadequate a lot of the time. And going up to this temple, Daibosatsu Zendo, was really a good vacation for me. It was a chance to get away from all these pressures, and for me, it was a wonderful experience, because we had Sesshin, and Sesshin is just this marvelous experience, right? You get up at 4:30, you show up at 5 o'clock, you recite sutras, and then you do Zazen and have breakfast, and then you do Zazen and you have lunch, and you do Zazen and you have dinner, and then you do Zazen and you go to sleep. And after, say, 3 days of that, your body, heart, and mind are really beautifully purified, and you have this wonderful sense of openness and connectedness. So I really enjoyed going up to Daibosatsu and doing Sesshin in that beautiful setting, and going through the very beautiful, liberating process of Sesshin itself. And I went up there a couple times in the summer for a number of years. And I remember going up there very enthusiastically once. And I walked around Beecher Lake. The Sesshin was going to start in the evening, and I got there early in the day. And I decided to do this walk around the lake. There's a trail around the lake. And I was walking around the lake, and there was a person on the other side of the lake who was staying at the temple, had been staying there for 3 months. And I said, the Sesshin hadn't started yet, so it was okay to talk. And I said, hello, who are you? And he said, he was actually, I think, a French person or Belgian. And he introduced himself, and he explained that he had been living there, but he seemed very distressed, very unhappy, you know, very, very unhappy. And we talked, and I said, so you've been living here? How wonderful. You know, it must be so amazing to live in this beautiful, peaceful place. You know, in the morning, you can hear birds singing their songs, like canyon wrens and other beautiful birds, and it reverberates over the water surface. And the temple itself is in the valley surrounded by mountains. And sometimes you can hear the call of the loon. I don't know if you know, but loons make this haunting call. It's really extraordinary. And you know, if you're deep in samadhi and you hear the call of the loon, it's just so, it goes right through you. It's so beautiful. And so I had many mornings sitting at that temple just soaking up the good vibes, you know, and feeling this wonderful openness. And so I said, it must be so wonderful to live at this temple. And he said, oh no, it's terrible. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, everybody here is so unhappy. Isn't that interesting? And he was unhappy. And he said, they fight all the time. They argue all the time. I said, wow. I had no idea, you know. I had this image of the temple. What a beautiful place. Everybody must get up in the morning and listen to the birds and go out, eat their breakfast. How are you? Good. How are you? Good. Oh, wonderful. And instead, you know, it was worse than my department. It sounded worse than my department. You know? I might as well just be back in my department. Nobody can get along. They're sniping at each other. They are mad all the time. In my mind, I was away from all that, but apparently not. You know, apparently not. When I started doing Zazen, I was probably depressed. I was pretty young. I was in my I was like 22. And I had come from like a really unhappy home. I'm sorry to say that my parents couldn't get their act together. They were really unhappy, and they argued all the time, and they finally got divorced after 17 years of marriage, and that was like 16 years too late. And they really should have thrown in the towel much earlier. You know, they were so... I mean, sometimes I'll be talking to my sister, and she'll just laugh. She'll say, they were so poorly matched, you know. They were just like, it was incredible, you know. How did they do it, you know? And so, you know, the atmosphere of our home was not a happy atmosphere. My father was really not a very healthy person psychologically, I would say. So the atmosphere of our home was very tense all the time, really unhappy. My father worked for, was a military person. So, you know, I grew up, a lot of my life was spent on military bases. And it might surprise you, but military bases are not happy places either, you know. There's a lot of tension on military bases. They're very hierarchical. There's a lot of people feel squashed and ignored by the system. There's a lot of alcoholism among kids who grow up on military bases. There's actually quite a high rate of crime and drug abuse. I had friends of mine who had gotten into trouble off the base with the police and that kind of thing. There were kids I knew who had drug problems and... So anyway, when I went to the Zen Center in Seattle, it was one of the life-changing events in my life. Because I went to this place and it was not like my home, you know. It was actually peaceful and people seemed happy, you know. And that Genki Roshi, the teacher, seemed especially happy, you know. And everybody would come in and meditate. And then they would all get off the cushion and they seem very nice, very peaceful people. It was the most peaceful, pleasant place I had ever been to in my life. It was the friendliest place I had ever been to. People seemed genuine. The teachers seemed genuine. It was a wonderful experience. And sitting helped me so much. When I would sit on the cushion, I would get off the cushion feeling better. I would start my sit with my mind scrambled. It was like a tense, sort of a burning heat. And I would sit for an hour and a half, and I would get off the cushion, and my mind was like a placid pond, or closer to it. And I would feel cool and refreshed, and I could go on with my life, and it was wonderful. It was just the most beautiful experience. And I began to do sesshin and to think, this is the path, you know, this is really wonderful. You know, I began to feel that, I don't know how to put it, but in my own life and in the life of other people, I saw so much distress and so much suffering, you know, that I began to feel, you know, I really want to, I began to feel, you know, I'd really like to be like a monk. You know, this ordinary human realm is so unhappy, you know. The home I grew up in was unhappy. The military bases were very unhappy. To some degree, the graduate students I knew were all unhappy. And I went to the Zen Center, and everybody seemed happy. And Genki Roshi seemed very happy indeed. So I thought, I want to get away from all of this. You know, this is terrible. All this crap. I want to go and just be a Zen monk somewhere. And for a long time, I had this idea that, you know, Zen is like, it's like going up the mountain. It's like going up a mountain. You know, you see the mountain in the distance, and you have to go through the trees, and the trees are very dense, and you can only get little glimpses of the mountain. Then as you go up the mountain, you know, the trees thin out, and you can see farther and farther. And it's like the horizon opens up and there's like this unobstructed view. And the higher you go up, the cleaner the view, the clearer the view. You know? And meditation training is very much like this. It's really wonderful. And you get up to the top of the mountain and it's just like, it's the way you've, I mean, I've been doing sesshin for 34 years, 35 years, you know, and it went about day three of sesshin, I'm up on the mountain, and it's just absolutely heaven. It's unobstructed in all directions. You know? And you can look down there at the forest and think, oh, I'm so glad I'm not in that forest. You know, it's such a terrible place to be. You know, it's so difficult. It's so, you know, people are so screwed up, basically. You know, and now I'm free from all that. And that's a nice feeling, very clean, very pure. But it's probably like a big mistake. You know, it's really a big mistake to think that way. And I think everybody who does Zen winds up thinking that way a little bit. You know, you wind up thinking that way a little bit. Because, you know, ordinary consciousness is really very confused. It's very confused. People are really unhappy a lot of the time. You know, they're trapped in their compulsive behaviors. They have all of these unresolved issues they haven't worked through. You know, they're constantly on the edge of their seats a lot of the time. They're terrified, or they're afraid, or they're jealous or envious, or they're, you know, it's like you're on the burning wheel. You know that image from early Buddhism? It's like a burning wheel, you know? You're up and you're down. When you're down, you hate it. When you're up, you're terrified. You'll go back down. And, you know, wherever we are, it's not where we want to be. We want to be somewhere else. And so it's possible to think about ordinary consciousness and ordinary life as really like this terrible place to be. And you know, in a way it is. It really is. It's like You know, people find a way to be unhappy, even if they're living on Beecher Lake in this beautiful temple. They can turn it into a really unhappy place because of their fears and their egos and so on and so on. And so, you know, it's possible to say, I want to get away from all that. I want to be up on the heights. I want to live my life on the heights. And yet, there's something wrong with that view. I was reading recently about the life of Yinshun, a great 20th century Zen, actually Buddhist teacher, not Zen. He was a Chinese farmer's kid, and he grew up very concerned about what life was all about. He had questions about why are we alive and so on and so on. And he began to read Taoism, and he began to read Confucianism, and he didn't find those very satisfying. He actually read the Bible, and he was very moved by the Bible. He found it quite interesting. But it still didn't satisfy him in some way that he couldn't describe, and he stumbled into some Buddhist literature. And he began to be fascinated by Buddhism. And he eventually became a monk. And he became quite famous. He'd noticed that Buddhism in China had gone into decline, and he wasn't really clear about why it was going into decline, or had gone into decline. And he spent the better part of his life sort of trying to work through meditation and study, a deep understanding of Buddhism. And the key to his understanding was an interesting idea, you know, that it's only possible to wake up in the realm of human confusion, basically, is one way to put it. It's only possible to wake up in the realm of human confusion. And that was his great discovery, you know, that all of this burning confusion is like a great, it is necessary for us to wake up. And by the way, this is actually the same recognition that Tsongkhapa, the great Tibetan teacher, had, you know. Early in his career, Tsongkhapa understood Zen Buddhist practice as kind of gradually distancing yourself from, you could say, the human, you know, all that confusion and suffering. And sort of like he saw Buddhist practice as like going up the mountain and leaving behind that village down there where people argue all the time and where they are so unhappy. Tsongkhapa practiced in that spirit for a long time. But then at the sort of like the peak of his powers, so to speak, he had this great revelation that that human beings were like the flower of enlightened mind. It's not like, you know, one way to think about our practice is like this. It's like basically human life with all of its confusion and suffering is like a mucky, dirty pond, right? And the mind is like a lotus that rises out of all this muck and confusion moving towards the sun. And so, you know, basically as we practice, we're leaving behind all of these attachments. We're leaving behind all of this confusion and suffering. And we're moving up through the water, and gradually the water gets cleaner and cleaner and clearer and clearer. And we move out of the, so we go from the mud into the clean water, and then from the clean water into the air, which is more pure than the water. And then we go into the light, which is more pure than the air. Right, and the lotus opens up in the light. You know, this is a model, one way to think about life. is you go up the mountain and leave the village behind. You come out of the muck and the confusion, and you gradually purify yourself, and then you open up in the sun of enlightenment. And Tsongkhapa said, "My God, that's completely wrong. That's completely wrong. I have it completely wrong." You know, we are like the flower of enlightened mind. We humans are like this. This realm of so-called confusion is the flower. You know, that's what Tsongkhapa said. And it's what Inshun discovered also. Inshun. He said, you know, basically, it doesn't make any sense to talk about enlightenment apart from human confusion. That human confusion is the precondition for enlightenment. And in the realm of the gods, there can't be any enlightenment, which is actually an old Buddhist teaching. In the realm of the gods, there can't be any enlightenment. You know, the gods don't have any problems. And so they don't get enlightened. They aren't enlightened and can't be enlightened. So this is a little different way of thinking about things, you know. It's definitely true that when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you bring your mind back into the moment, it becomes clearer and clearer and more calm and stable. And in that state, you can stop being agitated and fearful. And it's a most wonderful thing. So sometimes you come in to sit, to do your meditation, and your mind is really troubled. You're really agitated. Something has happened, maybe something at work. Even things like a medical report, you know. You can, I haven't had cancer, but I have certainly had I have certainly received news that's pretty hard to deal with. When my brother got cancer, that was very hard to deal with, for example. And when my brother died, that was very hard to deal with. It happened like 3 days before a sesshin, as a matter of fact. And I went to sesshin, and my heart was really broken. It was very difficult for me to do sesshin. In fact, I wondered if I were going to be able to do it, because I had a lot of emotional distress about my brother's death. But, after day one, day two, day three, it was like my mind became more and more still and calm, and I became, you know, more and more open. And that terrible sense of distress gradually went away, and by the end of the sesshin, I had this wonderful sense of, you know, connectedness and trust in life. And it was really metamorphosis. It was really wonderful. So Zazen really does that. Zazen really does that. And that's not, that's what it's all about, right? Is being able to reach that place where our trust in life is restored, and that sense of connectedness is restored, you know? And we can go forward without fear. That's so important. And usually when that you enter that state, it feels like the Buddha described it as being cool, or like a calm, or cool on a very hot day. You step into the shade and suddenly your mind is calm and you're cool after stepping out of the burning sun. So that condition is really wonderful. But, on the other hand, it's very important not to be afraid, having learned how to do that. It's very important not to cling to that, not to cling to the mountaintop, you know. The confusion is what makes it possible to wake up. You know, the confusion is what makes it possible to wake up. And so these two things sort of go together, you know, in a way that's absolutely indispensable. So, you know, there's a real danger for people who are trapped in confusion. You know, they can just stay trapped in confusion forever. And if they happen to do Zazen, they learn how to free themselves from that confusion and to become calm and centered and connected again. But then there's a danger for those people, right? Because you might find yourself sidestepping occasions when there's a real risk of getting back into the confusion, that burning confusion. Yeah. And then you're trapped in a different way, you know. I think being able to be a fully realized person means that we try not to run away from difficult situations, even though we know it's probably going to take away our peace of mind for a while. You know, we realize that if that happens, we can work it through. You know, we've been there before, you know, and we can do it. You know, you develop a kind of trust in the process. So, you know, every time you find yourself exasperated by human stupidity, or your own stupidity, or somebody else's stupidity, you know, it's important to realize that this is another opportunity to deepen your practice. When Jiyu Kennett, some of you might know about Jiyu Kennett, she was a really interesting woman. She was an English woman who wanted to be ordained as a minister in the Episcopal Church, in the Anglican Church in England. At this time, there were no women ministers in the Anglican Church. She was, you know, quite well qualified, and she fought hard to become ordained as the minister. And she actually got, or she actually became ordained. She went through all the training. She went to the theological school. She was, you know, at the top of her class. She, you know, fought it out with various opposition groups in the Anglican Church, and she persuaded everybody, and she finally became the first Anglican, female Anglican priest. But, you know, after that, she still wasn't satisfied. There was something about her experience of the world that wasn't fully developed yet, and she began to read books on Zen. And she decided to go to Japan and study Zen, even though everybody tried to dissuade her. So she went to Japan, and she was admitted by a very forward-looking Soto priest to a temple near Kyoto. And he was a very liberal, awakened person. He thought it was fascinating that this British woman wanted to study Zen, and he allowed her to shave her head and enter the temple and gave her a room and treated her like one of the monks. But even though he was very progressive and awake, the other monks were a bunch of idiots. And they deeply resented this woman being in the temple. They weren't enlightened, and a lot of monks in Japan are not particularly even very well educated. So they really had a lot of trouble with her. They felt threatened because she was a white person. They felt threatened because she was English. And they felt threatened because she was a woman. So it was they felt very unhappy that this foreign woman was among them. And they wouldn't have been happy, by the way, if it were a Japanese woman. They would have been probably even more unhappy, you know, because actually a lot of monks in Japan were quite astonishingly sexist. So anyway, nobody wanted her to succeed except for the abbot, and people would do things to embarrass her and make her look bad and discourage her and drive her out of the temple. So, you know, if people, the time to get up was 4:30, you know, somebody would say, "Don't worry, I'll wake you up." She'd say, thanks. So she'd sleep through 4:30, and she'd wake up and realize, "Oh my God, the light is coming up. How did this happen?" She'd race into the Zendo, and she'd be too late. And the Jikijitsu, the manager of the Zendo, would give her a scowl, you're a bad monk, what's wrong with you? And she'd be in trouble. Or somebody would say, you know, here's how to rake the gravel. And she'd rake the gravel, and then the gardener would come by and go, who told, what, that's totally wrong, you know. Somebody had set her up again. And this would go on and on. You know, everybody was unfriendly. Everybody was sabotaging her. And she went to the abbot, and she said, you know, I'm so discouraged, you know. Everybody's mean to me. Nobody's doing anything to help me. They give me bad information. They're trying to shame me. They're setting me up. And the abbot said, you know, everybody here, whatever their intentions might be, whatever they think their intentions might be, please understand that everybody here is helping you to wake up. And he said, you just have to keep reminding yourself that everything that's happening here is helping you to wake up. And she said it was like magic, right? You know, she jumped up every day, and it's just like no matter what kind of punishments people dished out to her, she said, this is helping me wake up. This is helping me wake up. And actually, that's true. Everything is helping us wake up. That's not a pious idea. It's a fact. You know, we have these expectations about how life is supposed to be. And some of them are silly and childish, but some of them are very, you know, we've invested a great deal in them, you know. Maybe it's the thing that's closest to our hearts, you know. And we have these dreams or these images of how life is supposed to unfold. It's so important that it work out this way. You know, it's so important. And then it all starts falling apart, and that can be so painful and so difficult. But on the other hand, you know, if we work that through, you know, if we work that through, on the other side of that is like a bigger mind, is a bigger life. These things that we hold on to with such desperation, you know, at some point we realize are like completely unimportant. You know, and when we enter that state of freedom, we're in a bigger life. So that's what Zen practice is all about, you know. Zen practice is about, in a way, working through these obstacles, these knots. And if we don't have these obstacles, we don't have these knots, you know, there's no chance of waking up. And there's no chance of deepening our practice. So there's a way in which people can be quite good at dealing with these problems, you know. You almost relish them. Kyogen Osho said, "It is like a man up in a tree hanging from a branch with his mouth. His hand grasps no bough, his feet rest on no limb. Someone appears under the tree and asks him, 'What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?' If he does not answer, he fails to respond to the question. If he does answer, he will lose his life. What would you do in such a situation?" This is, as I said, one of the most difficult koans in the whole book, because it's all about whether we're willing to be a little bit unhappy in order to deepen our awakened mind, really. You know, it's all about, you know, we cling to this idea of liberation, and liberation is real. And, you know, when you sit on the cushion, sometimes you feel so much better. Nobody wants to go back down into that hell of confusion, having gotten out of it, you know. But if you go back down, it will be even more wonderful when you work it through. So the question is, are you willing to go back down? Are you willing to go back down? Are you willing to fall? And if you're not willing to fall, then your training is over, and your light will grow dim. But if you're willing to fall, you know, it's an endlessly wonderful adventure. But you do fall, and it does hurt. Yeah? So I recommend that you fall. But you might not want to let go. Wumon's verse. Kyogen is truly thoughtful, thoughtless. His vice and poison are endless. He stops up the mouths of the monks and devil's eyes sprout from their body. Wumon's comment. Even if your eloquence flows like a river, it is no avail. Though you can expound the whole of Buddhist literature, it is of no use. If you solve this problem, you will give life to the way that has been dead until the moment, and destroy the way of life that has been alive up till now. Otherwise, you have to wait for Maitreya Buddha. In other words, you wait for the end of time before you wake up.